Chapter 54. Benignant and unconscious old lady who sat at his right shook his head, as much as to say, no, she couldn't have done it. He tilted the corked bottle over his glass again, meantime searching around with his watery eye to see if anybody was watching him. He ate a few mouthfuls, raised his glass to his lips, and of course it was still empty. He bent an injured and accusing side glance upon that unconscious old lady, which was a study to see. She went on eating, and gave no sign. He took up his glass and his bottle, with a wise private nod of his head, and set them gravely on the left-hand side of his plate, poured himself another imaginary drink, went to work with his knife and fork once more, presently lifted his glass with good confidence, and found it empty, as usual. This was almost a petrifying surprise. He straightened himself up in his chair, and deliberately and sorrowfully inspected the busy old ladies at his elbows, first one and then the other. At last he softly pushed his plate away, set his glass directly in front of him, held onto it with his left hand, and proceeded to pour with his right. This time he observed that nothing came. He turned the bottle clear upside down. Still nothing issued from it. A plaintive look came into his face, and he said, as if to himself, "Ick! They've got it all." Then he set the bottle down, resignedly, and took the rest of his dinner dry. It was at that table d'hôte that I had under inspection the largest lady I have ever seen in private life. She was over 7 feet high, and magnificently proportioned. What at first called my attention to her, was my stepping on an outlying flange of her foot, and hearing, from up toward the ceiling, a deep pardon, monsieur, but you encroach. That was when we were coming through the hall, and the place was dim, and I could see her only vaguely. The thing which called my attention to her the second time was, that at a table beyond ours were two very pretty girls, and this great lady came in, and sat down between them and me, and blotted out my view. She had a handsome face, and she was very finely formed, perfected formed, I should say. But she made everybody around her look trivial and commonplace. Ladies near her looked like children, and the men about her looked mean. They looked like failures, and they looked as if they felt so too. She sat with her back to us. I never saw such a back in my life. I would have so liked to see the moon rise over it. The whole congregation waited, under one pretext or another, till she finished her dinner and went out. They wanted to see her at full altitude, and they found it worth tarrying for. She filled one's idea of what an empress ought to be, when she rose up in her unapproachable grandeur, and moved superbly out of that place. We were not at Luke in time to see her at her heaviest weight. She had suffered from corpulence, and had come there to get rid of her extra flesh in the baths. 5 weeks of soaking, 5 uninterrupted hours of it every day had accomplished her purpose, and reduced her to the right proportions. Those baths remove fat, and also skin diseases. The patients remain in the great tanks for hours at a time. A dozen gentlemen and ladies occupy a tank together, and amuse themselves with rompings and various games. They have floating desks and tables, and they read, or lunch or play chess in water that is breast deep. The tourist can step in and view this novel spectacle if he chooses. There's a poor box, and he will have to contribute. There are several of these big bathing houses, and you can always tell when you are near one of them by the romping noises and shouts of laughter that proceed from it. The water is running water, and changes all the time, else a patient with a ringworm might take the bath with only a partial success, since, while he was ridding himself of the ringworm, he might catch the itch. The next morning we wandered back up the green valley, leisurely, with the curving walls of those bare and stupendous precipices rising into the clouds before us. I had never seen a clean, bare precipice stretching up 5,000 feet above me before, and I never shall expect to see another one. They exist, perhaps, but not in places where one can easily get close to them. This pile of stone is peculiar. From its base to the soaring tops of its mighty towers, all its lines and all its details vaguely suggest human architecture. There are rudimentary bow windows, cornices, chimneys, demarcations of stories, etc. One could sit and stare up there and study the features and exquisite graces of this grand structure, bit by bit, and day after day, and never weary his interest. The termination, toward the town, observed in profile, is the perfection of shape. It comes down out of the clouds, in a succession of rounded, colossal, terrace-like projections, a stairway for the gods. At its head spring several lofty storm-scarred towers, one after another, with faint films of vapor curling always about them like spectral banners. If there were a king whose realms included the whole world, here would be the place meet and proper for such a monarch. He would only need to hollow it out and put in the electric light. He could give audience to a nation at a time under its roof. Our search for those remains having failed, we inspected with a glass the dim and distant track of an old-time avalanche that once swept down from some pine-grown summits behind the town and swept away the houses and buried the people. Then we struck down the road that leads toward the Rhone to see the famous ladders. These perilous things are built against the perpendicular face of a cliff 200 or 300 feet high. The peasants, of both sexes, were climbing up and down them, with heavy loads on their backs. I ordered Harris to make the ascent, so I could put the thrill and horror of it in my book, and he accomplished the feat successfully, though a subagent, for 3 francs, which I paid. It makes me shudder, yet when I think of what I felt when I was clinging there between heaven and earth in the person of that proxy. At times the world swam around me, and I could hardly keep from letting go, so dizzying was the appalling danger. Many a person would have given up and descended, but I stuck to my task, and would not yield until I had accomplished it. I felt a just pride in my exploit, but I would not have repeated it for the wealth of the world. I shall break my neck yet with some such foolhardy performance, for warnings never seem to have any lasting effect on me. When the people of the hotel found that I had been climbing those crazy ladders, it made me an object of considerable attention. Next morning, early, we drove to the Rhone Valley and took the train for Visp. There we shouldered our knapsacks and things and set out on foot, in a tremendous rain, up the winding gorge, toward Zermatt. Hour after hour we slopped along, by the roaring torrent, and under noble lesser Alps which were clothed in rich velvety green all the way up, and had little atomy Swiss homes perched upon grassy benches along their mist-dimmed heights. The rain continued to pour, and the torrent to boom, and we continued to enjoy both. At the one spot, where this torrent tossed its white mane highest, and thundered loudest, and lashed the big boulders fiercest, the canton had done itself the honor to build the flimsiest wooden bridge that exists in the world. While we were walking over it, along with a party of horsemen, I noticed that even the larger raindrops made it shake. I called Harris's attention to it, and he noticed it too. It seemed to me that, if I owned an elephant that was a keepsake, and I thought a good deal of him, I would think twice before I would ride him over that bridge. We climbed up to the village of St. Nicholas, about 4:30 in the afternoon, waded ankle deep through the fertilizer juice, and stopped at a new and nice hotel close by the little church. We stripped and went to bed, and sent our clothes down to be baked. And the horde of soaked tourists did the same. That chaos of clothing got mixed in the kitchen, and there were consequences. I did not get back the same drawers I sent down when our things came up at 6:15. I got a pair on a new plan. They were merely a pair of white ruffle cuffed absurdities, hitched together at the top with a narrow band, and they did not come quite down to my knees. They were pretty enough, but they made me feel like 2 people, and disconnected at that. The man must have been an idiot that got himself up like that, to rough it in the Swiss mountains. The shirt they brought me was shorter than the drawers, and hadn't any sleeves to it, at least it hadn't anything more than what Mr. Darwin would call rudimentary sleeves, these had jing around them, but the bosom was ridiculously plain. The knit silk undershirt they brought me was on a new plan, and was really a sensible thing. It opened behind, and had pockets in it to put your shoulder blades in, but they did not seem to fit mine, and so I found it a sort of uncomfortable garment. They gave my bobtail coat to somebody else, and sent me an ulster suitable for a giraffe. I had to tie my collar on, because there was no button behind on that foolish little shirt which I described a while ago. When I was dressed for dinner at 6:30, I was to loosen some places and to tighten others, and altogether I felt slovenly and ill-conditioned. However, the people at the table d'hôte were no better off than I was. They had everybody's clothes, but their own on. A long stranger recognized his ulster, as soon as he saw the tail of it following me in, but nobody claimed my shirt or my drawers, though I described them as well as I was able. I gave them to the chambermaid, that night when I went to bed, and she probably found the owner, for my own things were on a chair outside my door in the morning. There was a lovable English clergyman who did not get to the table d'hôte at all. His breeches had turned up missing, and without any equivalent. He said he was not more particular than other people, but he had noticed that a clergyman at dinner without any breeches was almost sure to excite remark. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.